something I actually wanted to ask you is, do we possess the natural liberty to travel? If so, does the government recognize and respect that unalienable right?
Oh, do we possess the natural right to travel? Well, if we're freemen, we must. They don't require passports. In fact, the Constitution lets me move freely from one state to another, doesn't it? And I have to be recognized with the same rights as the citizens of that state if I come from this state. So, yeah, the right to travel is inherent in the Constitution, and there's nothing that provides for prohibition of that right to travel. So I have to say that natural right to travel, liberty to travel or right to travel, is absolute and unquestionable. It's unalienable. It wasn't even worth putting on paper when they did the Bill of Rights, because it was implied in the Constitution, because I could go from state to state without hindrance, unless I was a slave. Does the government recognize and respect that right? Well, that's a different story, but let's break it in two parts. Do they recognize? I think they do, because many people drive without licenses now. They're willing to take the time and deal with it. I proved it in court. So they recognize it. Do they give it freely? Do they respect it? Hell no. Their job is to raise revenue and licenses and trap us in an administrative agency.
Yeah, and also provide undue economic favor for their buddies, like the insurance companies that with the coercive automobile insurance that they make us buy here in Texas.
Yeah, and see, if it wasn't mandatory, then in the old days before what they call used to be you bought insurance for you to cover something that you did wrong, and you could also get insurance, a rider for uninsured motorists to cover damage caused by him when it wasn't your fault. And that no-fault insurance, they call it now. Back then, they didn't have no-fault. And so if I wanted insurance, well, it was mandatory, but I could get a minimum, and it wasn't that expensive. But it was still mandatory, which gives the insurance company the ability to set excessive prices on it and willingly pay the claims. But they said no fault was going to reduce the cost of insurance. And 3 years after they started no fault, the rates were almost double what they were before no fault. I mean, bullshit. But no fault means that you pay the uninsured motorist. This protects you. Well, what if I can't afford that protection and I'm going to rely on suing that son of a bitch and taking his house away if he causes the damage? Well, we don't want that. We don't want to deal with that in court. So you get this mandatory insurance and the prices start escalating. And now, shit, annual insurance premium can cost more than a new car cost when I was young. That's kind of insane.
Yeah. More like protection money.
So, that's one aspect. But the other one is revenues. The other one that gets me is something that started maybe 20, 25 years ago. And that's, you don't get points on your license if you go to this class. And you go to this class and you fork over $100 or $200 to a guy who takes all the cash or the checks and puts them in his pocket and preaches you to 10 hours. And these are indoctrination schools. The way they work is they'll act like you are the smartest people in the world. The guy will stand up there and say, okay, we're looking at what's going to make us safer drivers. Does anybody have any ideas? We're going to come up with 10 things that make us safer drivers. If somebody comes up with something, well, being a cautious driver and looking, being aware around you. So he looks at his little list and he says, perhaps we can rephrase that. Let's put it this way. And he writes it the way it is on his piece of paper on the podium. And he writes it on there. And then he comes with any other ideas. Don't drive drunk. Oh, that's a good one. Don't drive drunk. Do not drive under the influence of anything. And he puts that up there. And all of a sudden, after a while, this whole group of people paying $100 or $200 a piece have come up with this whole new set of 10 things that make you safe drivers, believing that they created them. And this is an industry. I mean, this goes on. I read an article recently that every time somebody gets a DUI and he wants to keep the points off of his record, he should be off the road perhaps after the second offense. But he just goes back, and they get more expensive on DUI, I guess. I've never had one. I don't know. But they've gone to DUI classes. Oh, I know who it was. This guy Fred wrote an article about it. They go 3, 4, 5 times, constantly forking monies to these schools. And these schools are getting filthy rich and probably making substantial campaign contributions in the process. So, yes, now we're getting back to political superiority, where they feed the people that will feed their reelection campaign.
Oh, geez. Okay. Well, do we possess the natural liberty to contract?
Well, Sleepy, you send me $1 and I'll send you an orange. You send me $5, I'll send you 24 oranges. I'm going to charge shipping and handling. We have every right. In fact, the Constitution says the state shall not impair the right to contract. We have an absolute right as free men to contract. But now we've got the government stepping in. Now, I'm going to give you for instance, and this is the way things were for 150 years. They're called covenants and restrictions on land. A lot of people had large estates. You know, all the land in this country started out at a big estate, and then over time it gets whittled down, either divided for family, you know, 160 acres, 40 for each of the four children, subdivision, creation of a town with small lots. But they all start out as a bigger parcel. Now, somewhere along the line, somebody might put covenants or restrictions on them, and one that was very common and constitutional, even after the 14th Amendment until the 1950s or 60s, probably the 60s with the Johnson Civil Rights Act, was that this land shall never be sold to somebody of the Negro race. And that was enforceable. And unless everybody from the parent parcel, the one that the covenants and restrictions were imposed on, if it was 160 acres or 40 acres, regardless of the size, the parent parcel, when that covenant and restriction was created, it would take everyone currently owning land in that to extinguish that. Not 90%, not 3/4, not 2/3, not 51%, but all of them had to relinquish that right. That contractual obligation. Now, the government wiped out all of them with one fell swoop of I got a pen and a telephone and I'll get things changed here. Well, they did that back then, back in the 60s. But with the Civil Rights Act, took away the right to contract. They've made the other contracts illegal. Now, from a legal standpoint, an illegal contract is not binding. Now, a legal contract would be, you know, I'm contracting you to rob the bank or kill my ex-wife or something like that. Those are illegal contracts. But otherwise, if it's not illegal, otherwise, we have every right to contract. Marriage is a contract, and my first wife's parents had a certificate of marriage on the wall. It wasn't issued by the state. It was issued by the church. Now, under the king, when we were subjects, and New Jersey was heavy on this, that you had to give notice that you were going to get married or the engagement, you know, and the governor had to approve it and all that. But when we became free, I think that was pretty much extinguished, that you could get married. And many people didn't even know where the county seat was. They'd go to the local church or a justice of the peace and get married, and a license would be issued by the church or the justice of the peace. One's by government, one's not. But or certificate was issued. I'm sorry, not a license. I'm not sure where the license concept came in, but in some research on it where I couldn't find dates, it appears that, if you look up marriage license in Black's Law Dictionary, it'll say refer you to miscegenation. Miscegenation is mixing of the races. So it appears from my research, like I say, I can't put a date on it, that a marriage license was required if two people of a different race wanted to get married.
Huh.
Otherwise, you didn't need a license. You could get measured by married by civil authority or the church or both, and you would get a certificate from each of them, but the license was only required for miscegenation. Now, you'll find quotations regarding that on the Verbicide page on outpostoffreedom.com, because Mary's license is one of the ones that I believe I addressed in that. I'm pretty sure he did. But so the concept of license at
Yes, he did.
The concept of license at first had a meaning, but then it became a power. Now, the power appears to come in the 20s or 30s when there was a lot of syphilis. So what they did then is say that you had to get a blood test to make sure that one or the other of you didn't have syphilis. There was a lot of syphilis back then. To make sure, you know, if you were going to marry somebody, they wanted to make sure you didn't marry into syphilis and then start spreading syphilis around, I guess. So they started requiring blood tests to get the license. So they converted from miscegenation to for the safety of the parties. Interestingly, though, if we look at that as the source of a license for everybody, if we look at it now, you get a blood test still. But if one of the partners shows that he's got AIDS or she's got AIDS, there's no obligation of the state to notify them that the other party has AIDS, but they would have to notify the other party if they had syphilis, which doesn't make sense because syphilis is a slower death than AIDS. but they're both fatal. Potentially fatal. So one would still be required to be notified and the other one would not. So the purpose of licensing seems to have been thrown out the window and all that's been retained is control. Now, another aspect of a marriage license is seeking a benefit from an administrative agency, whichever agency issues the license. There was a case that I read in Arizona years ago where there was a divorce, and the parents couldn't settle on custody of the child, and the judge said in the decision that when you got married, it was a three-party marriage. It was between you and the state. Now, if you two can't resolve your differences, then the state will resolve them. The state is also in interest in any byproduct of that marriage, meaning children. You know, that's a legal name for children, the byproduct of the marriage. So we, the state, being the final arbiter, doesn't have to agree with you or you. The state can decide to do with that child because they're the most senior of the three partners in the marriage. So we lost our right to contract in marriage. Well, I'm not married now, but I'm married now. I'm not married by license, by government, by any involvement of government at all, but I'm married because I understand what happens if I jump in bed with the state and my wife. I'd rather not have the state in bed with us, so I chose.
that would be kind of gross. But in fact, most people do it.
Yes, not literally, but figuratively, you've jumped in bed with the state.
Oh, wow.
Don't tell your wife, she might not like her bed partner all of a sudden.
Actually, I'm pleased to admit we don't have a license either.
Well, that's good.
Speaking now, I know we were talking about licensure earlier, but since you kind of brought it up again with in relation to contracting, I do want to ask, does the very nature of licensure infringe upon our liberties?
Well, let's see. If we have liberties, then driving, traveling is a right. Otherwise, we're confined with where we are. Excuse me. Maybe we could walk or something. But if a license is to do what would otherwise be illegal, what if nobody got a marriage license? Does that mean they can't have kids? They can't procreate? That's a God-given right. The government has no role in this. So, does it infringe upon our liberties? Absolutely. But wait, why does it infringe on our liberties? because we went up and asked Mother Government if we could do this. And we converted that right to a privilege and a relationship with government and binding us to the statutes that apply to that right. We have converted it from a right to a privilege. So you could say you infringe on your own liberties when you get a license. The state doesn't really do it because you walk up to the counter, right?
Yes, that's usually what happens. But yes,
the nature of licensing does infringe upon our liberties if we volunteer into that.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned about going up to the counter. Yeah, I mean, certainly it's just a series of submitting applications, you know. And so what do the words submit and apply mean? And it's not exactly a good situation to be in.
It's one I chose not to be in. I walked up the counter to get my driver's license. But again, that's to avoid the necessary hassle of dealing with the problem.
Now, does the American Bar Association maintain a monopoly on the practice of law?
Well, I've read a lot of things about the Bar Association, and what I've done is read other people's work. It's never been of interest. So I'm going to make some observations on this. I'm not going to state that they're fact. But the Bar Association, there are three branches of government, executive or legislative, executive, and judicial, usually in 1, 2, 3 in that order. The Bar Association, what I do know is they are under control of the Supreme Court of the state or the Supreme Court of the United States. If you want to practice for the Supreme Court of the United States, you have to make application. So that means a bar attorney has made application to an extension or an agency of the Supreme Court or the judicial branch of government. And in so doing, they become officers of the court, and they're given certain rights and privileges. But then they're members of the judicial branch of government, and if we got separation of powers between the branches, I don't see how they can be legislative or executive. They can't be the governor, they can't be the president, they can't be a representative or a senator, or even an assemblyman, because they're crossing the lines of separation of powers. That's an observation. I believe it to be true. Can't prove it. But there are other aspects, too. There's the missing 13th Amendment, which was ratified, at least recognized by almost every state in the Union in what we found, that would have precluded the privilege granted by the Bar Association. But that just kind of disappeared somewhere, and they replaced it with another 13th Amendment that we're all familiar with called the Anti-Slavery Amendment. As far as a practice on law, I found some interesting things. When I went to the Supreme Court with the habeas corpus, the supervisor of new cases, after a bunch of ordeal trying to get it before the court, said, "Well, you can't represent Mr. Myers in court."
Oh, yeah.
And I said, "You're wrong. I can. I have a power of attorney from him." And he said, "That's not good enough." And so then I did some research and found Whitmore v. Arkansas, 1990 Supreme Court decision, United States Supreme Court decision, that said if that person wants you and you have a relationship with that person, he's got an interest in you representing him, he can. But Whitmore v. Arkansas was a guy that didn't have that, but the case explained who would qualify to speak on somebody else's behalf, specifically in a habeas corpus. Well, it didn't mention power of attorney, but it did mention that relationship. But I told this clerk that, look, the power of attorney obviously demonstrates that that relationship exists because he's authorized me to speak on his behalf on all matters regarding habeas corpus. So that was the last ordeal. And then they docketed the case, and the court said, we don't want to listen to it. But it did get on the docket with that final argument, and it had to do with screw the monopoly. I can speak for Larry Myers. Let's go to the concept of power of attorney. As a surveyor and owning a business, we did engineering and planning and surveying. I would frequently represent my clients at meetings of the zoning board, the county commission, city council, board of adjustments, various entities. And quite often my clients trusted me, and they gave me a power of attorney to speak on their behalf and make decisions regarding a project that saved them the time of going down there. They trusted me enough to know that I'd do them justice. So I was allowed to represent them, even though I wasn't them, and I wasn't an attorney. Now, an attorney, all he has to do is go say, that's my client, and he gets to talk. But I had to provide the power of attorney so I could speak on their behalf. One other instance, when I went to Waco, I got a power of attorney from David Koresh. And then after the fire, I got powers of attorney from, I don't recall now, three different families. And for a couple years, a year and a half, I guess, after Waco, every once in a while, the JPs down in Texas would track me down. I was easy to find when I was traveling around the country. They drag me down and say, can we bury those bodies yet? No, they might be evidence in a criminal matter. The bodies were being stored in a freezer up in Dallas, Dallas or Fort Worth, I think it was Dallas. And so they respected the power of attorney enough to not bury or dispose of those bodies. Then an attorney from somewhere came in and signed up all three families. That overrode my power of attorney. I got a call from Kirk Lyons a couple weeks after I had read in some faxes that these people were being represented by this attorney pro bono. And Kirk Lyons called me and said the bodies have melted. So what they did is they pulled the plug on the refrigerating unit the bodies were stored in, but they never did that while I had the power of attorney, and the JPs recognized the authority of the power of attorney. So, yes, you can practice law, and what I call power of attorney specific, which is what I've always used, because it's not a broad or a general power of attorney. It's specific for this purpose or that purpose, that you can actually breach that monopoly that you're suggestive of, but otherwise it's not an easy thing to do because you can't just say, Gary, would you speak for me in court? No, that doesn't cut it. You have to take proper steps to get there. Otherwise, you can only represent yourself or hire an attorney to represent you. So it's an implied monopoly. If they had their way, it would be an absolute monopoly. But fortunately, the law still protects us from government to some degree by virtue of what's called a power of attorney.
What is the relevance of the missing 13th Titles of Nobility Amendment, especially with regard to the American Bar Association?
Well, so, I got involved with the missing 13th, the Titles of Nobility Amendment back in, I was in Las Vegas, Nevada, and it was probably late 1993. I had some good friends there, and after Waco, when I wanted to take a break, I could go down there and stay with them. And I met Brian Marsh, and David Dodge, and I can't think of the other guy's name. These two guys had been researching titles of nobility. It was an accident they ran across it when they were searching something else in the National Archives. Now, Brian Marsh, within a couple years, had joined the team and was one of the researchers. In fact, Brian wrote a number of letters to congressmen, to different branches of government, getting their reaction. And what was interesting is a lot of these disagreed with each other. But the fact is, almost every state, probably every state, recognized that it had been ratified. And then circular letter went out from Washington around 1850, I guess, and said, oh, that was ratified in error. But the proof is in the historical record, it was not ratified in error. But then people started withdrawing it from the law books. But we go from about 1820, all the way up to 1870 with people recording it in their law books. So I have to assume that it was ratified, and they didn't like it, and they took it out. So how does that affect the ABA? Well, the Bar Association, in the time of the founders, people were lettered in the law. That means that they, and if you read about Patrick Henry, his is an interesting story. But he had to go to three judges and get them to write a letter saying that he was qualified to practice law, that he knew enough about law to practice it. There's no bar association, anything like that. The bar apparently came into this country, I think, in the 1870s or 1880s, after the Civil War. I've never researched it thoroughly. This is what people have told me, and I have no reason to dispute it, because I don't find any reference to the Bar Association prior to that. But based on the title of nobility and a case, the only case that we've ever found that mentions title of nobility is from Alabama Supreme Court, and it was called Horst, H-O-R-S-T v. Moses, and I don't have the cite on it. But he said that the titles of nobility is giving anybody a privileged position that he didn't, was not given to others. And the Bar Association does that because they can charge you to go to court. I can't charge you for even for my time to go to court with you. I've got to give it for free if I go on a power of attorney or as an assistance of counsel. If I charge, I violated the rules. But then I think I mentioned earlier that the Bar Associations are subject to review by the Supreme Court. They come under the judicial branch of government, the Supreme Court of the state or the federal. And the right to practice is approved or rejected by that court. So you're a member of the judicial branch of government, but you're privileged. There's attorney-client privilege, and I still remember watching the video footage of O.J. Simpson's attorney, not in the criminal matter, but his civil attorney, walking out of the mansion with a suitcase. And they couldn't even mention the suitcase in the trial. I wonder what went on in that suitcase. So they're privileged. They can dispose of evidence. They can do all kinds of things, and you can't even ask them about it. So are they a privileged class? Well, what would happen to me if I saw you walk out with a suitcase in that situation, and I said, no, I'm not going to testify against him? Well, unless you stand on the Fifth Amendment and you're guilty of a crime, then you have to, and if we give you immunity, you have to anyway. But they don't do that to attorneys. So they are a very privileged class. And titles of nobility isn't prince, duke, or anything like that. It's just the relationship to the rest of the people. The concept of republican form of government that we have, if we look at even the Civil War, especially in the South, but in the Revolutionary War, these people had to be taught to take orders because they recognized now that we've gotten rid of England, we're free men. Almost a state of anarchy. So why should I take orders? And that's why it was so easy back then for letting a company elect their captain. Because then they agreed to listen to the captain. Because if it was, they took somebody they didn't know and said, he's the captain of your company, he's going, I'm not going to listen to that guy. I'm as smart as him. And as I read these old Civil War stories written by people that fought in the war, this theme keeps coming out that no man is better than another. They can earn their way up, but attorneys don't earn their way up. They don't have a good win record necessarily. I'm going to ask you a question. What's the average win-lose ratio for an attorney? The average?
Well, I don't know for certain, but I could have sworn it would be a 1-in-2 chance.
Well, it's 50-50. Lose half, win half. That's the average, because every time they go to court, one wins and one loses. There might be exceptions where both win or something, but I think those are pretty damn rare, and probably just a claim that they won. So would you go to a doctor that only had a 50% success ratio?
Oh, hello.
Okay, well, we go to attorneys that have a 50% success ratio, and that's pretty privileged. But I will say that since I've defended myself in court, that I have done better than any attorney's ever done for me.
Really?
Well, what can I say? I mean, attorneys, all they want is your check. I mean, I could tell you some stories about attorneys and my clients over the years, but that would make this too long and it's not really relevant, but they're more concerned with the money. They won't listen to you. They'll decide what's right or wrong. My run-in with Linda Thompson had to do with the fact that I'm going to decide, you can write it up, but I'm going to decide if we're going to submit it that way, or if I don't agree with it, then we're going to have to change it. And she didn't like that. That was the first of our rubs. They continue to grow over time. But the titles of nobility amendment would preclude people receiving a special privilege. And the concept of the founding of this country, you know, getting rid of peerage, you know, I've got an article in the blog called Social and Political Superiority. Let's kind of revisit the framers. Here you've got the elite, the social elite. There were Hamilton and maybe I mentioned this already. Hamilton and Franklin worked their way up. But everybody else had wealth. And so socially, they were the elite. They had social superiority. They had political superiority because back then only the social superiority people could be political superiority or representatives for the most part. There were exceptions like Sam Adams, people like that. But Sam Adams wasn't that successful of a legislature, really. He was just a pusher. But when they presented the Constitution, they did away with both social superiority and political superiority. And it stayed that way until after the Civil War. But now we've gotten back to greater levels of social superiority and political superiority than they did back then, because back then those that had political superiority did what they honestly believed was for the best interest of the community. They might disagree ideologically, but they weren't trying to line their pockets and their friends' pockets back then. So we've gone farther astray than they were even 230 years ago. So titles of nobility, in the plan for restoration of constitutional government, everybody rolls back to July 4th, 1860. At that point in time, the 13th Amendment, not the anti-slavery one, the titles of nobility amendment, was in effect in this country, and people that violated it would have lost their citizenship. So that's the rollback date. In the 13th, the original 13th then would be a part of the Constitution in the concept that I laid out in that plan.
Back in 1995, you helped to establish the Central Florida Committee of Safety. On the membership form, it asks the question, are you aware that there are at least two different classes of citizen in this nation? Why then, Gary, does answering no to the question make a potential recruit ineligible to participate in the Central Florida Committee of Safety?
I made the request to join. I didn't want to call it an application. I think we called it a request for to participate, something like that. But why was that in there? Well, let's go back to something that I felt for a long time, especially after this, and this was after I did that habeas corpus. But if I ever go to a jury trial, I'm going to want a jury of my peers. Now, what is a peer? Is it somebody on welfare? Is it somebody that believes cops always tell the truth? To me, somebody is my peer if they recognize that there are two classes of citizens. And it's not at least two, because there's only two that I'm aware of, and I would never put at least in front of that as you did. But if they recognize that there are state citizens and 14th Amendment citizens or federal citizens or whatever they want to call them, then they're astute enough and have the ability to think. I don't want some dummy that just follows the lead of the prosecutor and the judge. I want somebody that thinks. And I think that, you know, I believe that the judge could not tell me that I can't do that. Because if he does, I have a right to a jury of my peers. And all I'm trying to do is determine peerage. If they're my peers, I have no problem with them sitting on jury in this matter. But if they're not my peers, then they can't. And you know, where that came from is, there's a class system in England. There were serfs and there were mechanics, merchants, mechanics, you know, art, craftsmen, things like that, merchants that sold things, they were the lords and all that. And one group could not sit in judgment of another, up or down. And so if we do have two classes of citizens in this country, they're not ones above the other, but they're distinct. And as long as they understand that, then they are sharp enough to think out the aspects of the trial. That's the way I feel about it. So we put that on the request for participation in the Central Florida Committee of Safety, and it wouldn't keep them from joining. It didn't make them ineligible. What it did is it gave us a point to start educating them. It was not, there were some things in there that kept you from joining, and those had to do with the titles of nobility amendment. But this was to get people to think, what do you mean two classes of citizen? And then we'd explain it to them. And it didn't matter what their answer was, they could still join. Now, the guy that became the first chairman said, oh, if you're not a state citizen, you can't be on the Committee of Safety. And that basically ended, resulted in the Committee of Safety falling apart. He got elected on the sidewalk after a meeting at the library. I didn't want the position because I was planning on leaving Florida. And, you know, if I had stayed, we might have had a really good Committee of Safety. But we had a number of meetings. I wrote a couple pieces for all the members, and they disagreed with him, but he was the chairman, and we just never got it back together. But I think there, it's important that people understand certain things going into a Committee of Safety, because if they're a federal citizen, they can't be a member of the Committee of Safety. But if they're a federal citizen that wants to be a state citizen or begins to understand the benefit of being a state citizen, at least psychologically, then they can be in the Committee of Safety. So it's simply the awareness of that, that was that aspect of citizenship that was so important in the whole thing.
What are the typical abilities necessary for a state citizen?
Abilities necessary for a state citizen. An understanding. Like I said, state citizen has no merit in itself because the courts just refuse to hear habeas corpus, a right guaranteed in the Constitution. Not the Bill of Rights, but the Constitution. So they kind of ignore things. But if you want to test state citizenship or that state of mind, you have to understand to some degree the law. And it's not easy, but the first thing to do is whatever jurisdiction, if you're in federal jurisdiction, you want the federal rules of court, civil or criminal, whichever are applicable. If you're in a state court, or you want the whatever court you're in, you want their rules of procedure for criminal or civil. Sometimes they're joined together. Those rules is the rule book. If you walked up to a game of Monopoly and had never played it before and nobody read you the rules, you wouldn't know what to do. Free parking, go directly to jail, do not pass go, do not collect $200. What does all this mean? Well, you can't play unless you read the rules. And I'll give you a good example. Two of my friends, Emilio Pulido and Susan Mockdad, were part of the Florida Common Law Court. They ended up 12 years in prison. Susan died in jail. Emilio was in his late 80s when he finally got out of prison. But they taught me something a long time ago. This is back in the 80s. And that was rules of court. And I held off a foreclosure for 10 months against expensive attorneys. And in that 10 months, I got my down payment back. It's a long story, but suffice it to say that Susan primarily taught me how to use the rules of court to play paper chase and keep going back for another hearing, another hearing, another hearing until 10 months has expired. And at that point, I'd gotten all of my I got $9,600 of my $10,000 down payment back. I didn't pay rent during that period or pay my mortgage payments during that period. So I was only down $40 of the 10,000 or $400 of the 10,000. So that wasn't bad at all because I was fighting some big attorneys and it probably cost them thousands of dollars to fight me. That's understanding the law. But the important thing is not the law itself. The thing that takes most of our rights away is the rules of the court. Now, I'll give you a for instance of this. When I was traveling around the country, I'd take buses, get rides from people and things like that. And I happened to stop, and I think it was in Ohio. But they people were willing to put me up for the night, and he had a big day in court the next day. They had taken his truck, impounded his truck. And he had looked at the law, and he understood the law, and they didn't have a right to impound his truck. And he knew the witnesses to call. So next morning, we went to court, and there were 30 or 40 patriots in the audience. I was out there amongst them. And he had submitted four motions. I think it was four motions to the court. The court dismissed two of the motions and said he was holding the other two, pending the outcome of the hearing. And then he said, now we move to the evidentiary portion of this hearing. Now, the guy had already subpoenaed the witnesses and everything. But the guy sat there, and I just wanted to yell at him. But then the judge said it again. Now we'll move to the evidentiary portion of the hearing. And he waited 15, 20 seconds. We will move to the evidentiary portion of the hearing. About a minute later, he bangs the gavel and says, case dismissed. This guy was initiated the case to get his truck back. Case dismissed. Guy got up from his table, grabbed his paperwork, kind of stormed back, and everybody in the audience, we went outside. This is an old town with the courthouse and the square and then, you know, streets all around the courthouse. And there was a restaurant that everybody's going to. On the way to the restaurant, everybody was saying, look at that judge. He just dismissed the case. He didn't even give you a chance. And I said, wait a minute. He said, now we're moving to the evidentiary portion of the hearing. You should have called your first witness. The guy didn't read the rules of court. He just went in with the law. And because he didn't read the rules of court and understand what the evidentiary portion of the hearing was, he lost the case. If he doesn't offer a case, there's nothing to respond to. So the judge had to dismiss it. So people were kind of shocked at that, but I hope they learned from it. You've got to read the rules of court. He had a winning case, and he lost it because he didn't read the damn book. And didn't know what an evidentiary portion was. So if you want to defend yourself as a state citizen, don't say I'm a state citizen, but understand mentally where you are and take on the battle. But understand both the law and the rules of the court. Because the rules of the court got me $9,600 back, and the rules of the court cost this guy his pickup truck. You either know them or you don't. But yes, you have to learn. And it's not reading law as much as reading rules of the court. You have to understand the law and use it, but you have to use it properly. And you can't say, I'm a free man on the land, or I'm, what's that phrase that guy up in Minnesota said?
Oh, the one in Montana. Okay. Yeah, his version is a natural man.
Well, that's not going to buy you anything in court. That's not even recognized as a legal term. Oh, he could probably win his case if he read the law, because it has to do with a license, a fishing license. If he read the law, and especially went back and looked at earlier decisions, because more than likely fishing was a right except to people from other states somewhere along the line, and you have to wonder if the police powers of the state really give the authority to carry that forward to people. This is where we get despotic with administrative agencies. But then he had to understand the rules of the court and how to properly challenge that. So that guy's just acting like he lives in Colorado and stood in went into one of them stores and got him a whole big bushel full. He's way off base.
I think that's the way to put it. Why is it necessary for a state citizen to be very cautious with his language?
Well, I think we just touched on part of that. But here's a couple things to understand. If you piss the cop off, the cop will get back at you. And we see that over and over, that a lot of people get belligerent with a cop and something that shouldn't have happened happens, sometimes resulting in death. There was one, I think, in Colorado recently where the mother slapped the daughter and the father died with the police pressing on his chest right there in the parking lot, and then lied to the wife, oh, he's still breathing, when in fact I believe he was dead. But he got belligerent, apparently, from what the cops said, and they had to take him down. Same thing with the judge. You go into a judge and you piss him off, it doesn't matter what the law is. He'll take his chances with the appellate court if you're going to challenge it, but he will screw you because you pissed him off. So don't tell a cop his job. Don't tell a judge his job. Don't reflect upon the cop's heritage. Don't reflect on the judge's heritage, such as son of a bitch or something like that. If you intend to win, you have to keep it on an even keel. You also have to be very careful with your language in another aspect, too. There's an old saying in the income tax. This goes back to the early 80s when I first ventured into the income tax realm. There was a saying then, never talk numbers. If the IRS says, you owe $350,000, I couldn't possibly owe that. I didn't make that much. All of a sudden, I've admitted I owe taxes. Now, all we got to do is decide how much taxes I owe. Be very careful. Don't say the wrong thing, because a single word sometimes can bind you where you didn't believe that you were being bound. So you have to be extremely cautious with your language from a legal standpoint, as well as extremely cautious with your language with regard to your relationship with the cop or the judge or anybody else in authority. You piss them off, you're going to lose. Physically with the cop, legally with the judge.
What are primary resources regarding the legal aspects of statesmanship?
The Constitution and the Constitution, the big C and the little c. Also, there are some people who have done phenomenal research. There are other people that have regurgitated that research in a very poor form. Probably somebody that I spent 2 weeks with back in 1992 is a guy named Richard McDonald. He's down in California. I was in Florida at the time. I went out to visit my parents in Arizona, and then I drove out to Rich's place and spent about a week or 10 days with him, learning from him. The guy's got a law library that exceeds most attorneys I've met. And he taught me a lot. But now I'm going to say he has a program. He does give you some forms. He does, and I don't always agree with what Rich's conclusions have been, but he gives you the sources from which these rights emanate. So if you're going to look into the legal aspect, there's a lot to do to understand Supreme Court decisions on citizenship, and those would include Slaughterhouse. I don't know if Richard ever meant Twining, but everybody talks about state citizenship, talks about Slaughterhouse, because it recognizes some people are state citizens as well. It was much earlier than Twining, and Twining was just a reaffirmation. Within your state, you've got to look at your rights. If you've got a marriage license, don't expect the judge is going to say, well, we don't recognize you as marriage, and we're not in buried with you, so you two decide what it is. That's a contract. You know, if you want a divorce and both parties agree to it and come to terms, the court shouldn't even be involved. Hmm. But instead, you got attorneys. Right. There was a movie out back 20 years ago, I think, about this couple didn't get along, and they went and hired attorneys and started doing battle. And everything that they'd worked for, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of property, just went up in smoke in paying the attorneys. And they couldn't afford to complete the divorce, so they decided to stay married. And that's a reality when you get the attorneys involved. Well, you know, shit happens. Now, so you need to understand the source documents. And again, back to the Act of 1871, all these people talk about it, and nobody's read it. There's another one that's rather interesting. It's called Marbury versus Madison, and I think it was 1810. And people say, well, that's what the Supreme Court got the authority to interpret the Constitution. Now, of all the people I've talked law about, I've only met I think, three other people that really understand Marbury versus Madison. It didn't give them the right to interpret the Constitution. What it did is it said, if the legislative branch and the executive branch disagree on an aspect of the Constitution, they can't decide among themselves. So, therefore, the purpose of the Supreme Court has to be the final objective observer to determine what was really intended by the Constitution. But that's only, in Marbury versus Madison, was only a dispute with between the executive and legislative. It wasn't like the stuff we talked about in Ashwander where they try and avoid the constitutionality. And I can't really say, I've not researched when they started assuming broader and broader control, but I would say that somewhere around the time of the 14th Amendment, we started seeing this incremental encroachment into grabbing everything that mentioned Constitution and then deciding it based on statute rather than the Constitution.
I mentioned Richard McDowell a moment ago with his package of materials. So it does beg the question of, should state citizens buy template legal documents or should they draft their own?
Well, there are some documents that a template's not bad. And you know, from what I recall Richard's work, he gives you some basic instruments. He tells you what you need to know to fight a case. He doesn't address the rules of court particularly, but he does address fighting the case. But there are a lot of packages out there where they give you a handful of paperwork. I remember seeing one that referred to international law, federal law, and state law. And you can't mix jurisdictions. But if you fill in the blanks on a template, you don't know what you're doing, but you're answering questions. And if you go in with that little knowledge of the subject matter of what you're going in with, you're courting disaster. You're going to end up losing your pickup like that guy in Ohio. You're better to draft your own. Now, if you have a template that somebody is prepared for filing something, if you use that template as a guide as far as the structure, that's one thing. But fill it in yourself and know what you're filling in. That's the important thing. Habeas corpus, for example, I'm not sure if I use the right format. I don't think that they can refuse it on that because it's a right. And, you know, when I was a kid, they told me you could write it on toilet paper and turn it in because it had to be recognized. But apparently they lied to me when I was a kid. motions are very specific to rules of court. Writs of mandamus have a certain structure. Certain elements have to be in them. And you have to understand each of the elements. And like I say, to take a template and fill in the blanks, you're not going to have a good comprehension of the case.
Now, should state citizens represent themselves in court?
Well, if you could find an attorney that would represent you on a state citizen issue, let me know his name. I'd like to meet him. you almost have to. Now, I mentioned powers of attorney before. I believe that you can represent somebody with via a power of attorney if it's power of attorney specific for that case and you're both present, but only one of you can talk. So the guy can't say, I'm going to talk until I get stuck and then I'm going to pass it on to you. But I'll tell you about a case in Phoenix. I happened to be down there and a friend of a friend was going to court that day and I met the friend and she wanted me to come in with her. And so I went in and sat down at her table and the decision had already been made, but there were some details to be worked out. She lost, basically, but there were some details to be worked out, and she had gone in spouting off, as near as I can tell. I wasn't there. But I sat down with her, and the attorney kept glancing to me, and he'd look ahead, and he'd glance over at me and look ahead. And when the judge came in, we stood up, sat down, and he said, Your Honor, I'm not sure who this individual over here is. And I said, my name is Gary Hunt, and I'm here to offer advice to Miss So-and-so. I have no intention of speaking on her behalf. And the judge says, well, as long as you're quiet, I'm more than willing to let you stay. And the attorney gave me a dirty look and gave the judge a dirty look, and we proceeded. And so there, when some questions came up to her, I'd whisper to her or write down some things. And interestingly, the judge said at the end of the hearing, he said, that's the most intelligent discussion that's come out from that side of the courtroom in quite some time. So you can have somebody sitting there with you if that person's not going to speak. If they know what they're doing and you want to speak on your own behalf, you can try the power of attorney. I think that lawfully they can't revoke that right of contract, so to speak. Just if the guy that receives the power of attorney says, I'm getting paid for this, that's going to create a problem because that's practicing law without a license. But to assist somebody, I mean, the Constitution doesn't say you have a right to have an attorney. It says that the right you have the right to assistance of counsel, and you're acting as a counselor in that respect. So those two methods can work, but you need to make sure that you don't spout off like this lady did when she lost the case. And I've seen, you know, a lot of people spout off over the years. One guy from Ohio was going over, he had bought some land and he hadn't finished the mortgage and they wanted to foreclose on it. And he went in and I'd talked to him about some things to do and he threw those things in, but he threw in the fringe flag and he threw in everything else. And they just told him, get out of my courtroom, you lose. When you spout off, the more you say, the more they get. Let's go back to Ashwander. If they can find one reason to dispose of the case, they will. So when you say too much, you might give them that piece that they need to dispose of the case without consideration of the legal aspects of it.
True. So anything you can't will be used against you in a court of law then?
Well, you're in a court of law when you say it. So, yeah, it definitely can be used against you. And it there's an old saying, and I'm not sure that it's that true, but he who has himself for an attorney has a fool for a client. And there's probably merit to that if you're not versed and ready to go. And if you do represent yourself, here's something very important to remember. When I dealt with that foreclosure and got the 10 months out of it, listen to the other side. You have your ideas and you know where you want to go with them. And if you've initiated the action, you go with your ideas. But if you're the defendant in this thing, listen very closely to the other side, because they will tell you what's important and you have to respond to what they think is important. So it's very, very important to hear what they have to say and then figure out, think standing up, figure out how you're going to address what he just said. Make notes, but address what he said. Undermine his arguments. Don't assert your own. Undermine his. If you're if you've initiated the action, you bring your case. He'll respond to your case. Again, listen very closely, because he will tell you what he thinks his strong points are, and you've got to refute his strong points. Your best ally in court is the opposition's attorney, believe it or not, especially if you're a layperson, and like I still am, and not really experienced in the law. They will tell you what's important in that courtroom by what they say. Whichever side, whether they're plaintiff or defendant, doesn't matter. They will tell you what to say.
All right, so to be clear, though, there is a difference between the assistance of counsel, like is mentioned in the Bill of Rights, versus practicing law, then.
Yes, I think there is. And, you know, the times that I've been able to address that, it's dealing with justice of the peace with power of attorney, Larry Myers with power of attorney, and aiding this girl, this lady, by being her assistance of counsel, and the judge saying, as long as you don't say anything, I see no problem with this. Yes, but you got to be polite the whole time. Don't say, I have a right to be in here, I'm her assistance of counsel, because you'll be out there quicker than shit. And the bailiff will be glad to escort you out, maybe even to jail for contempt. So always be polite. Don't piss the judge off. Doesn't matter if you piss off the other attorney, but don't piss the judge off.
Should state citizens prepare to litigate their own cases by holding mock trials?
Yeah, over the years, many times we have Susan Mockdad walked me through some stuff for these hearings that I was going to do on the foreclosure. We had a guy, Kinney, up in South Bend that was going to go in on a habeas corpus. Earlier than that, he was going to go in on another traffic ticket. And two of us were just badgering him, throwing questions at him. Make sure he gets the right answer. If he made the wrong one, we stop right there. You said the wrong damn thing. Don't say that. Put it this way. And then we repeat the question or the accusation or whatever it was. But yes, because you get, you're not raw, green when you go into court. You've already dealt with being, and the reason for being harsh with the person that's going to be in court is he's got to learn to respond under pressure. And so you got to dump the pressure on him, probably more than the court would. If he says something, did you mean to say that? Is that what you really meant to say? And he'll stumble, but he'll get used to it. And so Kenny did on both the times. He's the only other person that successfully used habeas corpus, the one that I've got in What If I'm Arrested? In fact, when he told the prosecutors who were standing around waiting for the judge that he was going to demand habeas corpus, they told him, we decided to drop your case, so he never even got in courtroom on it. They dismissed the case before the judge got there. The other two times where I know people tried that, I am the moving party today, I set forth this demand for habeas corpus bit. One was Mike, the guy was in Ohio, and he threw this in with all the other things, and it just got lost in the mess. He recorded it, and I listened to it, and I heard habeas corpus every once in a while, but he was slinging shit. And so they picked something to hang him on. The other guy was a guy, I think he was in Apopka, Florida, and I talked with him on the phone and went over with him, and I told him, you have to assert yourself. You have to, I object to these proceedings. And when I talked to him afterwards, he never got the habeas corpus out because the judge kept, like he did with me, kept shutting him down. But I was persistent until I got it said. This guy gave up. He said, I tried, but I never got it out. So those are the only instances of people trying that, what if I'm arrested type oral habeas corpus and a traffic one. But Kenny was put on the stand on that. Well, what do you mean by habeas corpus? And I don't remember all of what we threw at him. The habeas corpus guaranteed by the Constitution. I can't find an injured party. You know, what right do you have to bring these charges against me? We put him on the spot on this whole thing, and he was fully prepared, but unfortunately never got into court to test it. But the prosecutors did choose to pull his file out of the box and write, I guess it was Noel Pross on it, and then put it back in the completed box. They go in with all these boxes each case, and they moved it to the other, wrote something on it, and moved it to the other box. And then it was affirmed, I guess, with the clerk of the court that it was dismissed, and so Kenny left. He didn't even stay around. But yes, those mock trials, it's not really, you could call it a mock trial. It's not got the formality of a trial or anything, but really putting the person on the spot and making them feel the stress, get in their face, yell at them, do whatever you have to do so that, well, when I used to work for a horse trainer, when they wanted the horse to lift his hoofs higher, they put weights on his hoofs. And he had to pick up those weights. And then you take the weights off and the feet just come way, or the hooves come well off the ground. And it's kind of the same thing because he's done it under stress with extreme pressure. And then it makes it a lot easier to do it in real life where the pressure isn't as great. And he's already had to express the right answers and everything. It's invaluable if you've never represented yourself before.
Now, I'm going to go into about being held in contempt in the context of spouting off at the judge. So is it common for judges to threaten a contempt of court charge against those who are asleep representing themselves in court?
I can't answer that. I've never had a charge to me. Anytime that I've gone to court, I've not heard it. It may have been thrown at Mike, the guy in Ohio that was spouting everything. I just couldn't hear anything because everybody's talking at the same time. It was like a news program. But contempt probably takes quite a bit, but if you piss the judge off, he's got the power to put you in jail without appeal on contempt. And the best I've ever seen of a contempt for 30 days being reduced is guy gets an attorney and probably negotiates with the judge and has it reduced. But you can't just – there's no way out of contempt. So don't put yourself in a situation. Insisting on your rights is one thing, but if you keep telling him that's a fringe flag and you don't have any jurisdiction over me, eventually he may find you in contempt. And then you're going to, you know, Gray Bar Hotel, free meals, room and board.
Understood. What is the significance of the rules of court?
Well, I think I've addressed that, but probably more than the law itself is the rules of court, civil or criminal, whichever you're in for. You need to, everything that happens, you need to have read already. If you get, there's usually paperwork before the trial, the paper chase. And so when you get a motion or something from the other side, go to the rules of the court. And here's one thing, for example, that I had the rules of court in Florida. And I found out I've got 10 days to respond to this motion, and I've got 30 days to respond to that type of motion. So they'd come in and they'd bring the motion to court. And I'd look at it, and they'd be waiting for me to respond to it. And I'd say, well, I haven't had time to look at this yet, so I'd like to have the 10 days. And then I'd come back with a motion that had time for them to respond. And so actually, even though we were in oral hearings, this paper chase was going on between us at these hearings. We never got to trial on it. I just kind of conceded it when I got my 10 months in, which is what I was my goal in the first place. So the rules of the court will tell you what you can do and how long you can take to answer something. If it gives you 30 days to answer, take 29 if you want to buy time. You want to put it on the other party? You want to get a hearing continued? Send him in the court, hand deliver to the court, and send him a copy 2 days before the hearing, and then put a motion in to continue the hearing to a future date. And then they've got to reschedule it if you want to buy time. I mean, there's all kinds of tricks. And that's why it's called the paper chase. So rules of court are the rules for the paper chase. And they are your friend if you understand them. They're your enemy if you think you understand what's going to happen in court.
All right, so how important are letter-writing campaigns to state citizens?
Well, I can't speak for all of them, but for me, they're a good way to communicate with your friends if you don't have email. And even if you have email, sometimes there are things you might want to say that you don't want to put in an email. But as far as writing them, trying to affect change, you ain't going to change a damn thing with letter writing campaigns, just petitions. I can't say that about petitions. There is a method for petitions, but it's not online. It's not standing in front of the grocery store. It's each person filling out a petition that has the elements that are necessary for a position. The problem, then an expression of the problem, and the consequence if there's failure to adopt the, for them to respond to the petition. And, you know, this is laid out, and it was based on research, not just of the Olive Branch petition, but numerous petitions that were circulated back in the 1700s, understanding that there are elements to this. It's just, we want free soda in the cafeteria is not a petition. It's a request. They call it a petition because everybody signs it. But a petition has as much a structure as a motion before the court, and it's got to have certain elements. But a letter writing campaign, I haven't gotten any because I haven't done any, but I've had people read me the condescending letters they get back when they write to their congressman and say, I'm pissed off about this, or I'm pissed off about that, or I hope you'll do this, or I hope you'll do that. And it's just he's got some aide there. He's never seen the damn letter unless there's a big check in it. And so some aide is going to respond to this and just shine you on. If you want to support the post office, I guess that's about the only benefit of a letter writing campaign.
Well, hearing you talk about state citizenship,
let me say one more comment. And I've done this a few times. I'd get so pissed off, even at a client when I had my own business, that I'd write a letter to that client. I'd have the secretary type it up, and I'd sign it, and then I'd tear it up and throw it in the garbage. It is a good way to release steam, but it's a very bad idea to hit send or put a stamp and put it in the mail. It can be a relief valve and help you get your thoughts out on the subject, but never mail it. That's a mistake. Okay.
Well, hearing you talk about state citizenship at length, I can't help but think of what would probably be the $60,000 question, which is, does state citizenship present me with an opportunity to increase the overall level of freedom in my own life?
Well, that's kind of a yes and no or a no and yes. Does state citizens present me with the opportunity to increase the overall level of freedom in my own life? You can't increase the overall level of freedom in your own life unless you know what that overall level of freedom that you are in and what it should be. So in that context, yes, it does. It's psychological, though. It's not physical. Can you accomplish certain things? As you broaden your understanding as a state citizen, you recognize things like habeas corpus. I didn't say I'm a state citizen when I went in there. I just challenged habeas, where's the contract, where's the injured party? So the state of mind, what I mentioned earlier, the state of nature, begins an opening of the mind. Being a state citizen and a dime will get you a cup, or $10 will get you a cup of coffee anywhere.
Can a United States citizen change his legal status or standing to that of a state citizen?
Well, again, legal status, that's kind of interesting because, you know, the laws don't really recognize legal status except in the cases that we discussed earlier. So, again, we're talking about a state of mind. You know, if you think you're free, if you believe you're free, you think you're free even though you're not free. If you know that you're not free, that state of mind is significant for going even further in that direction. But if I believe I'm free, I'm content. So, again, it's a state of mind. As far as standing, claiming you're a state citizen ain't going to change a thing. Now, I did have that Larry and I were state citizens in the habeas corpus. That was there for a reason, because I'm filing a petition for writ of habeas corpus, and in law there is a distinction. Whether that would ever be recognized at a lower court, that was in all the pleadings as a statement of fact only. It wasn't argued. It was just a statement of fact. Did it have any bearing? If they didn't hear the habeas corpus, it could have no bearing. So I can't say that it would have made a difference or not. I know that no court would hear the habeas corpus. They didn't hear it and deny it. They just refused to hear it.
How does one become a state citizen?
Well, what I did is I filed something Richard McDonald had called a revocation of a power of attorney, and it's an asseveration that you may have signed contracts or entered certain agreements with the government naively in the past, and at this point you're revoking any power of attorney that may have been conveyed by that. Does it have legal standing? I haven't found out how to use it in that capacity yet, but that's on record in Seminole County, Florida. I don't have the book and page, but it's in the public records, and I know it's there, and I know that I have asserted myself as somebody who has revoked my relationship with the federal government and the state government regarding any of those power of attorneys that were implied, and that is a comfort level in my mind that I have taken a step. And, you know, every journey begins with a single step, and that's a rather significant first step because you've done something. Though it may do no good in itself in your relationship with the government, it does a lot of good to you to say that I've done it.
is there any real expectation that we can use the law as a shield against government that is imposing all of these laws upon us that are robbing us of our wealth and demanding our unquestioning obedience?
Well, let's see. Since 1993, I've felt that there was no peaceful solution. And as I traveled around the country for 2 years, asking everybody, you tell me, what's a peaceful solution? Vote them out of office. Cut their finances. Stop paying taxes. Well, I don't pay taxes, but these people are still paying taxes. Nobody could give me a peaceful solution. And so for 20 years, I had... could only conclude that there is no peaceful solution. And then it occurred to me to try the habeas corpus. And after 2 years, almost 2 years with the habeas corpus, I've returned to the same conclusion. But I was hoping that perhaps there was a peaceful resolution, that the law would be recognized, that right guaranteed in the Constitution and expressed so thoroughly by the framers as to what it meant in the legal scholars of that era, what it meant, that this might be a peaceful solution and we won't have to take the more difficult road, that we can force them back in their own courts. It don't work. It didn't work. It won't work. And so I'm back to where I was before. There is no peaceful solution. There is the least offensive solution, and that's the plan for restoration of constitutional government, I believe, anyway. Yeah, but... No, the courts are in bed with the legislature, with the governor, with the police. You know, it's a clique, and they're all members of the same clique. It's just like the political parties. There's one political party with two factions, and the factions act like they don't like each other. And then we've got three branches of government, or four with the cops, or five with the administrative agencies, but they're all one clique, and they work together. They support each other. Why does a judge protect a cop and never find him guilty of murder except in extreme circumstances? Because that judge wants the cop to protect him from a pissed off defendant. So there's a symbiotic relationship within government where everybody's protecting everybody.
Well, Gary, I can't thank you enough for really taking the time and really just describing exactly what state citizenship is, the ins and outs of it, and so forth, because I know it's quite a vast subject area with a lot of topics and a lot of techniques. Unfortunately, too many people misunderstand. I mean, for instance, I remember the article you wrote about the Come and Take It San Antonio rally, and the main thesis of that article was the fact that demonstrators at that event were invoking the Second Amendment to the federal Constitution. But the only way that's even possible even here in Texas is by way of the 14th Amendment. Instead of what they should have been doing, which was invoking Article 1, Section 23 of the Texas Constitution.
If what you just said was true, they would have to rewrite that section of the Bill of Rights of the Texas Constitution, wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm.
So... you have to look very closely at the circumstances, but they're dealing with city police, and the city police work for a community that is created by the Texas Constitution. The counties and the cities, there are provisions for creation of these. So they come under the state constitution, which is different than the federal constitution. So yes, they were barking up the wrong tree by demanding Second Amendment rights in their fight with the police department. But that's, again, being a state citizen ain't going to get you out of jail free or anything else, but it will get you to begin thinking and understanding things that you never did before because you were raised and went to government schools, not public schools. They call them public schools, but they're government schools, and you were conditioned to something. And the greatest benefit of being a state citizen, when I first got into it, I thought it was going to be magical. And I found out over time, in a way it is, psychologically, but as far as getting anything, cheaper coffee or anything like that, it doesn't work a bit. But that first step is the recognition that I know what should be. And whether the courts will grant it or not, I know what should be. Now, that motivation, that I know what should be, is the first step in a long journey.
Well, I definitely look forward to trying it out myself. So, again, thank you very much, Gary. I really appreciate it.
Well, anytime, Sleepy.
All right, good night.
Night.